I'm Matěj Skalický and this is Czech Radio News Podcast Vinohradská 12. The man who once ran MI6, does he fear walking the streets? What shocked him about the Vrbětice terrorists? What was it really like dealing with Trump? And why, in his opinion, is China's president watching Putin's war in Ukraine? Sir Richard Moore joins us on Vinohradská 12. It's Sunday, May 24th. So hi, Richard. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's lovely to be talking to a Czech friend.
Yeah, it's an honor to have a small chat with you. Are you familiar with the fear of missing out phenomenon?
Oh, fear of missing out, FOMO. Of course I am. Yes.
Yeah, the FOMO. Yeah. Do you ever feel it in your retirement?
Oh, yeah.
Because there are top secret folders you can't open anymore.
No, this is very true. I can't and don't. There's occasionally a sort of pang of curiosity. So when this latest episode with Iran broke out, I definitely felt a bit, oh, I'd love to know what's going on and all that. But by and large, you know, I had the great privilege of doing the job of chief for 5 years. And then I had that great thing of being able to hand it over to a really good team and to a successor that I respect and admire in Blaise Metrovelli. And so you kind of feel your job is done. You know, you've brought the next generation through and it's time to let them move on. So I don't spend time pining for my former job.
Maybe on a more serious note, do you live with some sort of paranoia? Are you afraid as a former chief of a British intelligence service?
I don't think so. I know the point you're making that if you are kind of exposed over many years to some of the less attractive parts of human nature, and you have been involved in uncovering plots, and of course, occasionally doing some of your own plots. The danger is it slips over into paranoia in a sort of Le Carré type way, John Le Carré and Smiley and all of that. But I don't feel that way. I live my life. I hope I can trust in other human beings as much or as little as anybody else.
In your final years in office, how often were you in contact with the Czech intelligence service?
Oh, frequently. Absolutely.
Frequently. On a daily basis?
Frequently. Perhaps not on a daily basis, but, and of course it ebbs and flows. If you're doing operational business together, then it might be more frequent. But remember, the Czech services and MI6 are in touch on a daily basis. I, as chief, might not have been talking to my Czech counterparts that regularly, but I certainly visited Prague very regularly. As you may know, I didn't give very many speeches, public speeches as chief, but one of them, and one of the really critical ones, I delivered in Prague. And I did that for a particular reason, because for MI6, many of our most important Soviet agents came to us because they were dismayed and disgusted by what they saw in 1968 in Prague, the crushing of the so-called Prague Spring. And that turned some of them, or it was the final straw which broke the camel's back, the final thing that led them to reach out to MI6. So it felt, in the circumstances of a war next door in Ukraine, it was time to appeal to Russians who may be dismayed by what Putin is doing in their name, to come and help us. And that's why I chose Prague. So yes, very regular interaction with the Czech services, who, by the way, are outstandingly good, really professional, and they understand Russia in a way, frankly, that only countries which used to be part behind the Iron Curtain can truly appreciate.
When details of the Vrbětice terrorist attack emerged in 2021, it turned out that the attack had been carried out by the same Russian agents who poisoned former double agent Sergei Skripal in England a few years earlier. Were you involved in the Czech investigation? Have you helped your Czech colleagues with that?
Yeah, we worked, without going into too much detail. We now all know that it was exactly the same two officers of the GRU of Unit 29155, Mishkin and Chepiga, who carried out the attack in Salisbury in 2018. 4 years after that incident. So clearly, we compared notes both at on an intelligence level, but also on a law enforcement level, to understand the activities of 29155, and we put a lot of effort into understanding the activities of that group. And you know, the two incidents really, in their different ways. You know, in the and I'm struggling, of course, to pronounce Bertice, to pronounce the name of the town, but there, you know, two Czech citizens, civilians, died as a result of that. And of course, in Salisbury, the target was a Russian defector, but the person who died was a British civilian, Dawn Sturgis, who lost her life. And it's the commonality of it. There are several commonalities. One is just, you know, this is very much the pattern that we now understand of grey zone, of hybrid activities by the Russian intelligence services. And the other thing connected with that is just how reckless they were of innocent life. Now, their preparedness to create explosions in the Czech Republic, or to use a military-grade nerve agent in a small town in England, is breathtaking in its recklessness. So many other people could have died in both incidents. And the other thing is a sort of a real lack of professionalism. Whilst the Czech services and MI6 were cooperating, and MI5 and the were cooperating on the on this issue, and we were slowly unraveling the two incidents and being able to make connections across them, a commercial company, Bellingcat, was able to do a lot of the same work and uncover it, because the two officers concerned were so unprofessional. They left so many tracks back into Moscow and into and near their headquarters. It was striking. And I think we all remember that appearance on Russia Today, when they were just comically awful. They were so obviously frauds. And I remember meeting a leader, I won't name them, who had been quite skeptical, and we had just said that 29155 was behind Salisbury. And I saw him after that TV show, and he said, "Richard, Richard," he said, I did. I thought MI6 was lying," he said, "but I saw those two guys on the television, and they were so grue," he said. "They were so obviously Russian military intelligence."
In both cases, Salisbury and Vrbětice, the revelations led to the expulsion of Russian diplomats from several countries across Europe.
Yeah.
Has that made Russian intelligence operations in Europe much more difficult?
Yes, it has. It's been a real success. I think we drove the numbers down by at least a half, maybe more. And the Czech Republic followed the UK in setting a really robust line on this. And it's one I was trying to encourage other European partners to hold to, which was basically to enforce reciprocity of numbers on the Russians. The Russians love to have large embassies in your capital, and if you let them, they will. And of course, many of them will be intelligence officers undercover. So the best way is to ratchet it down, kick the people out that you discover are intelligence people, and then don't let them replace them. And we have been pretty successful at that in the UK over the years. And it means that the security service doesn't have so much to do, because it's not following all these people around. So the Czech Republic was very brave and very forthright, and it definitely worked. And when you see some of the activity involving now the use of petty criminals, people recruited online to go and do sabotage, arson, etc., that is an expression of weakness. That's because they can't do it themselves through 29155, and they have to kind of subcontract it out. And these people that they are hiring often don't know what they're doing. They're not professionally at that level. So they are relatively easier to counter. They're still dangerous. I don't underestimate the threat that they pose, but it is an expression of weakness that the Russians have been forced into this thing. And it reflects the fact that we collectively did a really good job after Salisbury, and then following up after the Russian reinvasion of Ukraine in February 22. We did it again, and we took down the numbers even further.
While you were still in office, you said that the biometric data and facial recognition have made it much harder to operate under false identity abroad. Are there technologies that can still get around this?
Well, if there were and we were using them, Matthias, I wouldn't be telling you about it on air, would I? But, you know, very clear, anybody who's an international traveler, anybody who goes through airports knows now that you go through biometric capture. You know, it could be your four fingers, couldn't it? Or it's your irises when you look at those screens. And very clearly, you can only have one name and turn up in the same airport. And you can imagine that maybe that wasn't always the case. Look, it's always an issue for a human intelligence service that the things that are put into airports and elsewhere to capture terrorists, which we all want as good citizens, also sometimes make it a little bit more difficult. But you develop new techniques, you find ways of getting the job done. And it's a kind of, you know, it's a bit of an arms race. You're always, you know, moving from one to the other. That's why in the UK, the cooperation between MI5 and MI6, MI5 being the domestic service and MI6 being the overseas service, is so close because we help each other. MI5 can explain to us how they're catching the bad guys, and we can learn from that and try and avoid getting caught ourselves. So this is through the history of intelligence work. This is always the way that one door is closed and you have to open a door somewhere else so you can carry on doing the necessary work.
Maybe that's the reason for starting your YouTube videos in several languages and looking for agents abroad through dark web.
It's not. I've
seen your videos.
You find a way, and we find a way. That's why I hope we have a reasonably strong reputation to keep doing it. And we also have a strong reputation for looking after the people, the brave men and women who decide to come and work with us against various targets. So, you know, you find other ways, but YouTube and the thing that you described is a kind of modernized version of, as was my speech in Prague that I mentioned earlier, of appealing to Russians to do the right thing and come and find us and providing a means for them to do it securely via the dark web. So, yes, but we've always been the beneficiary of people coming and finding us, if you like, rather than us necessarily finding them. And that remains the case.
How did cooperation with the United States change during your career?
Oh, well, it's very, you know, it's very embedded. And particularly the US-UK relationship in intelligence is very embedded because it goes right back. In fact, it goes back to the First World War, but then it really was reborn in the Second World War around amazing work at Bletchley Park on Enigma and shared work on ciphers. We were instrumental in helping the Americans to set up the Office of Strategic Services, which then later became the CIA. So there's a lot of history of working together. And over those years, it's evolved. Obviously, in the Cold War, it was a cooperation focused on the state threat from the Soviet Union above all. And then we had in the 9/11 period a real focus on counterterrorism. And now we're back into state-on-state competition. And the relationship between the US and the UK, but also between the US and other European services, has gone around through that. And it's also true that at various points since the Second World War, US policy on certain issues has diverged from some of the European countries' views. We found ourselves in a very different position from the US in the Suez Crisis in 1956. Many Europeans opposed the Vietnam War. But we find a way of keeping the intelligence relationship going through these differences. And I guess, you know, the obvious one today is there's clearly a difference between the Trump administration and Europe over military action on Iran. But through all this, we keep the intelligence exchange as far as we possibly can away from the politics, away from the policy, so that whatever the choice of policy, you can see the intelligence to inform your decision making. And as I'm out, I've been out now for 6-8 months, but I strongly suspect that people on both sides of the Atlantic are working hard to keep that intelligence relationship in good order, because it's not about sentiment or charity matters. This is about keeping our citizens safe and about working together in our respective national interests. In other words, it's transactional at its core. It's about, you know, delivering benefit for both sides.
Yeah.
It's not about some great sort of charitable endeavor.
Yeah, I get that. I'm very interested in this modern era of relationship between UK and the United States. Did you lose access to some classified intelligence in the Trump era? Has the Trump isolationism influenced your Secret Service?
I'm a little out of date. Let's enter that caveat. But you have to understand two things. One is the simple answer to your question is no, not as far as I'm aware. But then the nuance in response to your question is this. No country, however close, ever shares all the intelligence they have. There are always something, in America, they call it no form. No foreign, because there are some things that are so sensitive and they are kept for sovereign reasons you don't share. So let's be very clear. There are always some things you don't share. It's not an open book. Second thing is, when you share intelligence, you don't tend to tell the other partner the name of your secret agent or the exact SIGINT access, signals intelligence access you have into the opponent. You don't do that. You share the finished product and you rely on a sense of trust between partners to say, look, we have some high confidence in this material, or this is lower confidence material. You don't allow people under the bonnet, to use a motoring analogy. So I am pretty confident that the intelligence exchange has not been severely impacted, because both sides, again, it comes back. Why do we do this? We share intelligence in the national interest. We do it because it gains us some benefit and saves lives. It's not always narrowly transactional. You say share intelligence to save lives in the Czech Republic. You do it because you share the values, and of course that's the right thing. And you know that the Czech services will do exactly the same for you, you know, when it comes to it. Not in some quid pro quo, just because that's the right thing to do and we share the same values. And I'm very confident that continues to be the spirit that animates the relationship across the Atlantic.
Richard, can you tell me if MI6 had any influence on Trump's view on what was happening and what is happening in Ukraine?
You know, President Trump will look to the U.S. intelligence community for insights. You know, we don't go in to see him directly and say, Mr. President, here's a great report. We share with our American counterparts, and then they will draw on that intelligence in terms of the briefings they give to the president. But because the relationship between the U.S. and U.K. in the intelligence field is so strong, our intelligence, I'm very confident, when we have good intelligence and we share it with our American counterparts, it will be used to inform the president's thinking and his decision-making. What he then decides to do, the decisions he makes, those are Mr. Trump's. But I'm very confident that he has access to good information, including good British information.
What's the greatest threat facing the world today?
Oh, my goodness. That's such a difficult... It's a great question. And it's a really difficult one to answer. So I think you can talk about the sort of geopolitical issues of the day. We've clearly got a serious situation in Iran that needs resolution, not least so that the Straits of Hormuz can be opened up again to international trade. We've got the rise of China as a power second only to the United States, hugely important power. We as Europeans need to decide strategically over the long term what type of relationship we're going to have with the People's Republic of China, because, you know, I think in some ways over the long term, The People's Republic of China poses the biggest threat to the international system that has served Western democracies so well over these last 80 years. They want to change that in their favor. And I think that may come up against our interests and our values. So that's a kind of longer term one. And not to mention climate change, agentic AI, where that goes. But the most important issue on the international agenda, without a doubt, is Ukraine. We have to ensure that Putin does not succeed in Ukraine. We have to ensure that we keep our support. The Czech Republic has been one of the most prominent supporters of Ukraine since 22. We need to keep that going because if we falter, if we fail to meet that challenge, not only will Putin's appetite grow with the eating, he may be emboldened to do other things which are damaging to Western security. But behind him, President Xi Jinping is watching this, and he will make judgments about the Western resolve, and he will make judgments, therefore, on what he does in the South China Sea, what he does in Taiwan critically. So there are all kinds of reasons why, for me, Ukraine is the central struggle of our time.
Okay, thank you for all your answers. Thank you for your time.
It's been a real pleasure.
And that's all for today. I spoke to Richard Moore, former MI6 boss. He was a guest at this week's Fragile Security Conference organized by Czech Radio. Thank you for listening.